available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello and welcome to Outlook. I'm Stella Roberts and this edition is being recorded on Wednesday, the 3rd of July, 2024. Coming up, we have another in the series about Warwickshire villages, read by Elaine. Keith concludes the story about Liesel Herbst, Austrian tennis player and refugee. And Nigel has been investigating the world of audiobooks. Sue tells us something about the secret history of Africa. And Dave and Graham finish their trip to Bath and Bristol. Elaine looks at what's on locally in July. And in the sports spot, Nigel looks back at the Olympics in 1900. We also have our usual features, news from the Resource Centre and Postbag. But first we review the past week's news with readers Elaine and Peter.
Outlook News.
There are only a few days to go until Coventry's much-anticipated Godiva Festival. Thousands of people will be heading to the festival at the War Memorial Park from this Friday, July the 5th, to Sunday, July the 7th. There will be many music revellers who have come to see their favourite artists on stage. This year, headline acts include Palomo Faith, Richard Ashcroft, Beverly Knight, all on the main stage, with others including Sam Ryder, The New Heavies, Holy Goof, Richie Rich, and more set to entertain the crowds. There are six stages at the Godiva Festival where superstar artists to local independents starting out in their careers will be performing. The six stages include the main stage, the next stage, the serendipity stage, the Cov Connex Kingston stage and the Resonate stage. The next stage is known as the second stage, where visitors can enjoy back-to-back drum and bass on Friday night, and a house and dance combo all day on Saturday. The serendipity stage will be located amongst the fun and games in the Coventry College family field. It will be open on Saturday and Sunday and host everything from dance troupes to kids' beatboxing lessons. The Cov stage is for those looking to discover Coventry and Warwickshire's next big artists. Every year the stage hosts local artists working with industry professionals and BBC Coventry and Warwickshire. The Cov Connex Kingston stage is a community stage that serves as a platform for emerging artists to empower young talent across the city. Rooted in the historic twinning of Coventry and Kingston in Jamaica in 1962, the stage celebrates Jamaica's rich musical heritage and its influence on Coventry's local artists. And finally, the Resonant stage is the musical heart of the Powerhouse Youth Zone, presented by Media Mania and Powerhouse Studios. There will be over 50 young musical talent celebrating how far they've come and an impetus for growth in their music career. There will be everything from soul to rap, poetry to rock, and pop to R&B.
Campaigners at the University of Warwick have ended their 13-day-long occupation of Warwick Manufacturing Group's International Digital Laboratory after administrators agreed to enter into negotiations regarding demands for divestment from Israel. Organisers of the pro-Palestinian group Warwick Stands with Palestine took over the building by barricading the entrance and exits. The group claims to have had consistent refusals to renegotiate from university management for 60 days and for 9 months of campaigning prior to this. They now claim that the reversal comes as a victory indicative of the strength of their sustained pressure campaign and the determination of the student movement at Warwick to fight for justice. A spokesperson has said that the university is seeking to enter dialogue with Warwick Stands with Palestine. One student said, "It's absurd that we've had to go to such lengths to establish a line of communication. But we're happy to be finally entering into this dialogue. This occupation is a clear demonstration that creating pressure through direct action is an effective tool in forcing institutional change. In a statement on X, Warwick Stands with Palestine wrote on Monday, "Holding such a large and important building for 2 weeks is a remarkable achievement and demonstrates the strength and determination of the student movement at Warwick and beyond to fight for justice. Our occupation and subsequent victory was the culmination of a year of mounting pressure from students and staff and guides us with hope and determination onwards."
Bringing down the cost of doing business, especially for small firms, should be a top priority for the next government, so say the region's business leaders. The Coventry and Warwickshire Chamber of Commerce has also called for a focus on skills and a greater provision of employment land in the run-up to the general election. The Chamber says it plans to work with the region's new MPs after the election to ensure companies have the best opportunities to invest, grow and take on new staff. Steve Harcourt, Director of Prime Accounts Group and President of the Chamber of Commerce, said there were a range of measures which could ease the burden on doing business. He said the next government will not have a huge amount of headroom on tax, but if it can look to reduce the cost of doing business, it will have a positive economic effect. The Chamber will continue to push for a business rate overhaul in order to create a fairer system that will help to drive more people back onto our high street businesses. He would also support a rise in the VAT threshold because, again, this would have a positive impact on smaller, lower turnover businesses and give them a better opportunity to grow. He said the next government should incentivise businesses which invest in green, sustainable methods of doing business. He said rising interest rates and accessing finance remain a barrier to business growth. The Chamber's Chief Executive, Corin Crane, said he would also like to see greater support for international trade to reduce the cost of exporting. He added, "The next government needs to commit to support businesses that are either starting out or that want to expand in order to ensure our economy is given the best possible chance to grow."
With the possibility of another heatwave this month, health experts have sent out a warning about 6 key symptoms of dehydration to look out for. Medical professionals at Now Patient have provided this list of 6 common markers of dehydration, along with 5 tips to ensure adequate hydration during a heatwave. The 6 signs include feeling thirsty, headaches, dizziness, tiredness, a dry mouth, and dark yellow and strong smelling urine. Navin Kosia, a pharmacist at Now Patient, said, "High temperatures, although welcome news to many, can pose serious health risks to those who fall into the vulnerable category, which is why it's crucial to keep hydrated, stay in the shade, and apply sun cream throughout the day. Staying hydrated is the key to feeling fit and healthy during these hot periods, and you shouldn't be taking drinking water for granted in a heatwave. It really is essential. I would recommend drinking 20% more than your usual intake," he said, "and replacing the consumption of tea, coffee, alcoholic beverages and sugary drinks with water. This change may not be to everyone's taste, but you could add flavour to your drinks through fruits, whilst milk and smoothies are also good options to help replenish a lack of fluids." He concluded, "Some of the advice I can give you is perhaps more forthright, and I cannot stress enough the importance of checking your urine. This may not be a common thought for most people, but the colour and smell is a key indicator when it comes to dehydration, and it should become apparent to you if it is dark yellow in colour and strong smelling."
The Archbishop of Birmingham, Bernard Longley, joined dozens of staff, governors and pupils past and present to celebrate a landmark 65th anniversary at Cardinal Wiseman Catholic School. The special occasion, part of the Romero Catholic Academy, saw members of the school community gather at the St. Charles Lwanga Theatre for a memorable Mass. Archbishop Longley, the second most senior figure in the Catholic Church in England and Wales, led the Mass, celebrating the school's long-standing commitment to Catholic education. Cardinal Wiseman Catholic School, located on Potter's Green Road, has been serving the community since it opened in 1958 under the Archdiocese of Birmingham. He said, "It's a great thing to come together to remember those pioneers 65 years ago who had a vision for Catholic education in this part of the city. I'm very grateful to all the staff for inviting me and thank former members of staff and students for supporting the school community, not just tonight but on many occasions over the years. The St. Charles Lwanga Theatre is a very fitting place for our gathering of the Eucharist, with a real sense of thanksgiving and gratitude as we move closer to the end of another academic year. The event was attended by current and former staff and pupils, including former head teacher Angela Whelan, current principal Matthew Everett, and sixth form student Kieran Fawcett, who all shared readings and reflections. Father George Bennett, parish priest for St. Patrick Coventry, also celebrated the evening Mass. The school band provided music, and Year 10 pupil Isabel performed the responsorial psalm, with the congregation joining in full voice. Margaret Knight, daughter of Cardinal Wiseman's first head teacher, Tom Hope, said, "I've been back to Cardinal Wiseman a number of times over the years, but today has reminded me a lot of how things used to be and how much has changed. I came to school here the year after my father started, and things were done very differently back then. It's been really interesting to see his name on the official documents and records, and lovely that people have had the chance to come together today."
A survey of 2,000 adults revealed that while 79% of them sympathise with the current state of the NHS, 55% believe changes need to be made regarding the meals served. The general consensus on the meals served is that they lack appeal, are bland and devoid of flavour. A quarter of respondents felt the hospital meals were often served lukewarm or cold, with the same percentage believing that the portions were too small. And when it comes to the food served, 64% believe that healthiness should be the top priority for hospital meals. Interestingly, 41% said they would support the introduction of plant-based milks and yogurts in hospitals as an alternative to dairy. The research was commissioned by Plant-Based Healthcare Professionals UK, which advocates for plant-based meals to be the standard option in hospitals and in healthcare institutions, mirroring the policy in New York City. Dr. Shireen Kassam, founder of this community interest company, stated, "There's certainly an appetite to see change. Naturally, there will be many that perhaps wouldn't be as keen, but often, once ideas are implemented, people adapt very quickly. Everyone has a vision in their minds when they think of hospital food, and it's rarely positive. So it's certainly time the food had a refresh. And," he said, "plant-based dishes not only offer health, financial and climate benefits, but they're more colourful and flavoursome too. According to data from onepoll.com, 30% of respondents believe that processed meats like ham and bacon should not be served to patients. However, there is concern that the public may not support the introduction of plant-based menus in hospitals, with 23% expressing this worry." Dr. Kassam commented, "By encouraging a higher consumption of plant-based foods, we can try to reduce the prevalence of heart disease, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, obesity, and even certain cancers. Aside from the health benefits, a typical plant-based meal uses less land and has a 2.5 times lower impact on biodiversity than does one containing meat. A modelling study has shown that this plant-based by default approach could save the NHS £74 million annually, and if patients were also supported to make those dietary shifts at home, there would be significant household cost savings too."
A tired area of Coventry could be getting a facelift, with new shops and flats and residents are having mixed feelings on the plans due to the council going to approval. The proposed scheme for the Westmead Centre in Waverley would see a new Heron food store and a block of flats on the land at 10 Whittaker Road. 65 parking spaces would also be provided, split between the customers and the residents. A statement by agents CDRB Architects said the scheme will regenerate a brownfield site and provide a more modern and viable convenience store. It added, "The Westmead Local Centre has been identified for some additional development now that the local community facilities on the west side of Whittaker Road have been completed. The area at the rear of the local centre is poorly laid out and is looking tired and in need of enhancement, which the application proposals would clearly achieve. Plans were validated by the council this week and are yet to be decided on." One comment was, "Mixed feelings about this. On one hand, the whole complex is run down and depressing, so this could help cheer things up and bring in extra trade for all the businesses there. Conversely, Heron Foods is an Iceland-type business, as far as I know, so will they still provide all the services the existing store does? More housing and less parking? Another said, "Sounds like a plan, but who will be moving into them? Hopefully, people from Coventry that are stuck in privately rented housing that they can't afford."
The Rialto Plaza in Coventry is set to shut its doors in August before it undergoes a major revamp to introduce a completely new offering. The decision to close the venue comes as part of an effort to keep pace with the changing dynamics of the hospitality scene. A series of events will be held in July, with the finale being the UB42 Tribute Act, who were one of the first bookings when the Cowden-based venue opened back in 2012. Rum and Reggae Live and a Dirty Dancing Party Night are also set to be held next month and will cost just £1 to attend. The closure signifies the end of an era for this beloved event space that has a host of great shows and events throughout its history. Commenting on the venue's storied past, one resident said, "This place has been many things over the years, bingo hall, etc. My mum and my auntie used to go dancing there at the end of the 40s. Good luck on your new adventure." Another added, "If it is reopening, then hopefully they change the seating back to lovely round tables and chairs rather than the awful beer keller look. The atmosphere and the ambiance aren't the same, which puts a lot of people off wanting to go." A third added, "I'm going to the 80s night in July, and I hope that's not the last time I'll be able to visit."
Green-fingered community groups in Warwickshire are set to receive extra support as Warwickshire County Council announces new funding opportunities for the creation of community orchards and micro-woods throughout the county. The scheme, funded by DEFRA's Coronation Heritage Living Fund, empowers residents to plant a lasting tribute within their local communities while fostering a more sustainable environment in Warwickshire. Councillor Heather Timms, Warwickshire County Council Portfolio Holder for Environment, Climate and Culture, said, "This is a fantastic opportunity for communities to come together and create a lasting legacy for future generations. These projects will not only provide beautiful spaces for residents to enjoy, but also contribute to a more sustainable county by increasing biodiversity and improving air quality. It aligns perfectly with our commitment to creating a Warwickshire that is not only beautiful, but also sustainable, both now and for future generations." The Fruitful Pursuits Community Orchards project aims to reverse the decline of traditional orchards by enabling communities to plant a variety of fruit trees in underused green spaces. These community orchards offer numerous benefits beyond providing access to fresh fruit. They support wildlife, promote natural land management and serve as a hub for residents to connect, engage in community activities and enjoy a unique learning environment. Schools and community groups can explore wildlife, planting and tree maintenance, fostering a hands-on educational experience. In addition to orchards, the scheme promotes the creation of community micro-woods. Inspired by the planting method of a Japanese botanist, these miniature woodlands utilise mixed native species planted at high density to create a natural growth pattern in urban areas. Microwoods increase tree canopy cover, contributing significantly to Warwickshire's overall tree cover. Unlike many traditional planting methods, these woods require minimal maintenance after their initial establishment and are less vulnerable to vandalism.
Coventry's Sports Fest event will be returning with 6 days of free activities this summer. It will be held in Broadgate and will run from August the 6th to the 11th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. each day. Coventry City Council is staging the event in partnership with CV Life, and local sports clubs will be present at the event, as will sport national governing bodies. Cricket, laser tag, archery, augmented reality games, dance and table tennis are all on the schedule for the week, plus much more. Councillor Cameron Khan, Cabinet Member for Public Health and Sport, said, "Sports Fest is a major highlight of Coventry's summer events calendar and is loved by residents across the city. The event is completely free to attend and covers many different sports and activities suitable for all ages and all skill levels. Previous Sports Fest events have attracted thousands of residents and visitors. Make sure you add the dates to your diary and join us in the city centre." Steve Wiles, Chief Operations Officer at CV Life, said, "Local clubs and organisations will be offering a wide range of engaging activities suitable for all. We hope to see a great turnout for a week of free outdoor fun and to get many people nice and active this summer holiday."
The Carpenters Experience is bringing much love hits to Coventry this autumn. The UK's leading tribute to the iconic duo, the Carpenters, will be taken to the stage in the auditorium at Coventry Building Society Arena on Saturday, October the 19th. Their appearance follows a string of sell-out shows across the country, featuring the voice of Maggie Nestor and eight top-class musicians. The show captures the essence of the Carpenters, bringing back the sounds of Richard and Karen Carpenter to the live stage. The show is now in its seventh year and sees Maggie as Karen and Coventry's own Jason Forrester as Richard. With a full live band including brass and piano, the pair deliver seamless harmonies to recreate the experience fans would have had seeing the Carpenters live throughout the 1970s. Fans can expect to hear songs including "Close to You," "We've Only Just Begun," "Top of the World," "Rainy Days and Mondays," "Solitaire," "Goodbye to Love," "Please Mr. Postman," "For All We Know," "Only Yesterday," and many more classic tracks. Over the course of their 15-year career, the Carpenters recorded 15 albums and the duo sold more than 100 million records worldwide. It is the first time that the show has come to Coventry and is part of the continued expansion of the live entertainment offering in the auditorium at the Coventry Building Society Arena. Mick Mason, who founded the Tribute Act in 2015, said it's exciting after 7 years to be bringing the show to Coventry. "It's an immersive show which will take fans right back to the heights of Richard and Karen Carpenter's career. These songs are 50 years old now, but they are timeless and still resonate with people all over the world." Jenny Ford, Director of Sales and Marketing at Coventry Building Society Arena, said, "This is a must-see show for any Carpenters fans, and we're expecting a full auditorium on the evening."
Outlook News.
And we'll know what these are here for, these are here to be done. Many thanks to our readers, Elaine and Peter. I've got the daylight hours for this week. Dawn is around 4 a.m. and dusk at 10:20 p.m. I'll give you news of the band concert on the 14th of July at the War Memorial Park between 2 and 3:30. The Brass Band of Central England will be playing. And Hugh has joined us in the studio now with your What's On at the Resource Centre.
Thank you very much. Yes, well, we've had quite a lot of excitement here today. I mentioned last week about bees in the bins. Well, we no longer have bees in the bins. A nice man came and took them away, 4,000 of them apparently, and he said, oh, that's not very many. He was like, oh, okay. But what they did leave behind was some very nicely formed honeycomb.
Yeah, beautiful, it's in the kitchen.
It is, and yeah. There's a little bit of honey in one of them, which is delicious, as you might imagine. But there we are. So the bees have gone. Well, most of the bees have gone. Actually, there are about. About 100 or so that are a bit left behind, and they're currently gathering on the edge of recycling bin in the hope. But there we are. So I'm sure they'll go off and find other places to be bees. But it's all very exciting, really. We've got some footage of it, and I think that might make it onto our. Facebook page at some point very soon. The good news is that now we can empty the bins, so because they've been very full for quite a long time. So just a little note that the summer garden party, of course, is taking place on the 13th of July. We'll be hoping for much better weather than we've got currently. I can tell you, it's got a bit of time to change. It is looking like it's starting to warm up again a bit next week, but. It's certainly been a bit miserable this week. I've had to put a jumper back on and go back to my winter hat. It's terrible. My wide-brimmed Panama style, not actual Panama because I can't afford them, hat, has had to be retired for the week. Now, I mentioned last week that we have some second-hand CCTVs available for sale here at the centre. I mentioned that one of them was an Optilec Clearview C for £200. Well, I'm sorry, that one's no longer available because somebody has snapped that up. But we do have still two Optilec Clearview Pluses, which are the older ones, which are available at £50 each. I've had another one come in, actually, so I've still got the same number of CCTVs. And this is a Rehan IC CCTV. It's not your usual type. We just need to clean it up a little bit, but it works fine. We're going to put that on for, well, £50 as well, possibly, but I may accept offers below that. And we still have the little Acrobat CCTV, which has got a small monitor that goes along with it. They're very good machines, those, and they're £75, that one. It's got a platen that's separate. Anyway, it tucks away very small and away. Now, the bus has been a bit of a saga, again, as you might know, that somebody nicked a bit off it again. So we've sourced the parts and everything. We're just waiting, actually, for one more to arrive, and then hopefully we'll be able to get that back into action. We're looking in the early part of next week at the moment. We're keeping our fingers very tightly crossed on that. And really, I've not got much to say this week, surprisingly. We've got, now, on the 9th of August, down at the Cottage Pub in Earlston, there's going to be a rum tasting session. I've mentioned this before, I think. So this is an evening session from 6 p.m. until 10 p.m., so that's 4 hours in which to taste a lot of rums, and the tickets, they're pricey, they're £40, but you get to have a really good evening exploring the wonderful world of rum, and getting to taste quite a few of them, and I think in the end it's a very good value evening. So if you fancy it, or you know somebody who might, we have tickets available for that, and they're available at reception. Coming up before then, on the 27th of August, no, where are we? July. There we are. 27th of July, of course, we've got the inflatable 5K that is going to be happening down at Warwick University, and we've got a team of 8 people doing that. If you fancy sponsoring any of them, among them are Chris and Claire and Joe, you can do that. There'll be, basically, it's a 5 kilometre obstacle course over inflatable, bouncy castles, really, for want of a better word. So that will be a great deal of effort for them, and we do help that people with support. And of course, on the 17th, I'm wanting to say, of July, we've got Joe Proctor's sponsored silence, and I'm sure many people will be willing to contribute towards that. Bless her socks. So, I think that's it for this week. I will keep you posted about what's happening next week. We're getting into the summer holidays, of course. We had to cancel the walking group today because the weather was a bit foul, and certainly while we're in the unsettled weather, the outdoor activities, we'll certainly look at those each day. We'll try to give a bit more notice than we managed today, but anyway, otherwise things carry on as usual. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you. No sport this week, as Sarah is celebrating her birthday. So instead, we're bringing you a feature about the Olympics in the year 1900, read by Nigel.
Millions of sports fans around the world are limbering up for the Summer Olympic Games in Paris next month. But everyone involved will be hoping the tournament goes smoother than the shambolic 1900 Paris Games, which threatened to derail the entire Olympic project. It was the event's second ever modern version, and the first held outside Greece. The inaugural Games in 1896, held in Athens as homage to the ancient Olympics, had been hailed a moderate success, and the Greeks lobbied to keep them. Instead, the French founder of the modern Olympic movement, Baron Pierre de Coubertin, argued successfully for the grand occasion to be held in his home city of Paris. However, instead of the springtime of humanity he wanted, the half-baked games became a riot of wacky contests, intrigue and bust-ups, interspersed with odd gallant sporting triumph. Coubertin had envisaged the construction of grand stadia around the city, and to cash in on the appeal of the 1900 World Fair, also being held in Paris. Instead, organisers of the Expedition Universelle gained control, sidelining the International Olympic Committee and its visionary president. They put exhibits of new scientific wonders, including escalators and movies, to the fore, which, alongside a newly opened Eiffel Tower, overshadowed the Games. Worse, the Jeux Olympiques, started in May, were spread across 5 grueling months with no opening or closing ceremonies. Minimal publicity meant many of the 50 million visitors to Paris that summer were unaware of the tournament at all. Some competitors didn't even realise they were Olympians, with many contests called International Contests of Physical Exercise and Sport. Conditions weren't ideal for the official participating 1,226 athletes either. Track and field events were held on an uneven grass field, often waterlogged and dotted with trees, in the city's Bois de Boulogne Park. Broken telegraph poles were used as hurdles, while the hammer and discus area were so narrow that many of the projectiles ended up in surrounding foliage, almost hitting spectators. The marathon was held in a blazing 39 degrees centigrade, with only 6 of the 13 runners finishing. Swedish leader Ernst Fast got lost 3 miles from the end because the course was poorly marked. France's Michel Theateaux won, but other competitors accused him in vain of cheating by taking shortcuts he learnt as a Paris bakery delivery man. American Arthur Newton came fifth, but maintained he'd not been passed by any other runners, while countryman Dick Grant complained of being run over by a suspect cyclist. Non-finishing British runner Ernest Poole said the marathon turned out a disastrous fiasco with an entire absence of precautions to ensure fair play. Tempers boiled over in the long jump too. Many competitors shunned events held on a Sunday for religious reasons. Myers Prinstein thought he had an agreement with fellow American Alvin Kreinslein not to compete in the final held on a Sunday, but Kreinslein participated and scooped first prize. An outraged Prinstein hit him in the face. Poor scheduling and organisation meant many spectators and even the athletes themselves never made it to the events, some of which were distinctly odd affairs. Tug of War made its Olympics debut, but involved a single six-a-side match. A French team, which included a Colombian, was beaten by a mixed Scandinavian outfit of Danes and Swedes who'd roped in a journalist meant to be covering it. Croquet was rather one-sided, as all 10 competitors were French. Cricket's only appearance at the Olympics saw a Great Britain side, made up of journeymen members of the Devon and Somerset Wanderers Club, beat France by 158 runs inside a cycling stadium. The French, it turns out, were mostly recruited from British embassy staff. Great Britain won the football, thanks to an Upton Park Football Club side, but the lacklustre rugby team arrived and left Paris on the same day. Swimming events took place in a swirling river Seine between two bridges. The spectator sport of underwater swimming failed to make a splash, baffling its 14 competitors. Charles Devon Deville won it by swimming 60 metres while submerged, edging out Denmark's Peter Leichberg, who remained under 22 seconds longer, but only covered 28.5 metres after mistakenly paddling in a circle. Equestrian events included a high and long jump for horses, while the fencing was aptly held in a field next to the World Fair's cutlery exhibition. Oddest of all was the pigeon shooting. Described by organisers as très aristocratique, it became the only event in Olympics history involving the killing of live animals. The eventual winner, Belgium sharpshooter Léon de Lunda, felled 21 unfortunate birds out of 300 in all. A hot air ballooning contest, firefighting, kite flying and cannon shooting also featured, but the tournament did have genuine sporting highlights. Some 22 women participated in their first games, and British three-time Wimbledon tennis champ Charlotte Chatty Cooper became the first individual female Olympic winner. She triumphed in the ladies' singles in straight sets and the mixed doubles. In golf, American amateur Margaret Abbott happened to be in Paris with her mum Mary on holiday, and both entered. Margaret won with 47 strokes over 9 holes, lamenting that opponents had apparently misunderstood the game by playing in high heels and tight skirts. Australians introduced front crawl in swimming, while ex-polio sufferer Ray Avery won the now-defunct standing high jump, standing long jump and standing triple jump. By modern reckoning, Great Britain finished third behind France and the US in the medal table, with a tally of 32 and 15 golds. Winners of this Olympics received silvers, not gold medals. The event and its equally chaotic cousin 4 years later in St. Louis in the United States, where few international athletes even competed, has since been dubbed the Farcical Games. But Coubertin battled on. Olympics held in London restored the tournament's allure. By the Paris Games of 1924, they had become an established sporting competition, and a delighted Coubertin was there to oversee proceedings.
Oh dear, let's hope that the Olympics 2024 go a little bit more smoothly. I especially love the marathon runner who took shortcuts learned on his bakery round. We now go over to Dave, who's waiting with your postbag.
This is Postbank. Join in the discussion.
Hello there, welcome to your Postbank. And I'm riding a bike. I'm riding a Beryl hire bike down Barkerbutts Hill. And the reason I'm on a bike is to introduce the first report, and it's by Julia, and it's entitled Riding Along on the Push Bike, Honey. Julia writes, well, it's a tandem really. We went to Knowle last week. That's in the countryside, that is. I'm not sure where it is really, but it's a long way from Coventry. My friend John said he went there on a canal boat once, but all he remembers is a pub. We went to the Red Lion. When we went with Vista, the weather was really nice. Not too hot and not too cold. It was a lovely evening. I had a J2O because I didn't want to get drunk and get arrested like last time. Simon was my pilot and we went fast but didn't take off. I had a chat with my friends Graham and Sue. I like Vista outings, but we need more young ladies like me to slow things down a bit. It would also make our chats a bit more sensible with more ladies. We were all very sad to hear of the death of Darren, Edwina's son. Apart from Vista, I also enjoy the walks we have. This Wednesday we went around the Memorial Park, and I understand it was Darren who started those walks during the COVID lockdown. He will be sadly missed at the resource centre. Stay strong, Edwina. Love, Julia. Thank you, Julia. Yes, it was Darren that organised those walks. Sheila and I would meet them for a socially distanced picnic afterwards. He was very kind. Ali Verney used to come on his bike and stop and talk to Sheila, which she appreciated very much. I remember they had tea and biscuits outside the church on a Saturday morning when I went to Knowle to have my computer fixed for to help me with me scripts and postbag, and I had my computer fixed in the shop there. Elizabeth of the Monday Club came to my eldest son's folk club, the Tump, for a folk charity evening in memory of Sheila, Yonderland and friends. I am pleased to say the total raise for the resource centre has gone up to £455. Elizabeth loves folk music and has sent us this brilliant report on the Tynmouth Festival by leaving a message on the postbag answer phone on 02476 717 522 and pressing 5 for Coventry Talking Newspaper. Here's Elizabeth.
Hello everyone, Elizabeth reporting from the Tynmouth Folk Festival where everyone is having a great time. The Beltane Border Morris dancers from Dartmoor have put in a stunning show, as always. The Estuary Band from Tinbridge have performed Jolene and other folk classics very good. The Back Beach Boys with Bob Freshwater have sung some hilarious maritime and typically Devonshire numbers. But I'm now sitting at home recovering. See you all next week. Bye.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. That was really great. Please keep them coming, your reports. You're a really good reporter and great fun to be with, like on the Alpaca Walk and the Move for Fun Walk in the Memorial Park. And now we have another bonus in postbag, the return of Jag Singh with some really helpful information about help with shopping to your doorstep. That's Morrison's Doorstep Delivery.
Hi guys, my name's Jag and I'm a visually impaired guy from Fulham, Coventry, and just like to share something very interesting that I found out. Probably like a lot of people with limited eyesight, going shopping or sometimes using apps or website can be a bit of a mission, shall we say. And I recently discovered that, I'm not advertising them, but it's Morrison Supermarket. They do what's called a home doorstep delivery service. And it's brilliant. You ring them up, and then you create an account, and it's like a telesale service. So rather than mess around with a phone or apps and stuff, you simply ring them up, you give them your account details, they've got your payment details, they ask you to go through some security. Minimum delivery is £25, which is quite reasonable. And it's honestly, guys, it's just been brilliant for me. Just not worried about asking anybody to send an order for me. Not worried about going into a very busy, busy store. I simply ring the phone number, put my order in, and it gets delivered pretty much the next day. It's called Morrison's Doorstep Delivery. That's what it's called, Morrison's Doorstep Delivery. Not advertising the supermarket, I'm just advertising a really good service, which I think a lot of us will benefit from. Have a good day, guys.
Thank you, Jack, for that really helpful information for your fellow listeners. Keep them coming in. The Morrison's website says you can order over the phone and pay when they're delivered to your door. Which is usually the very next day with our doorstep delivery service. There's a minimum order of £25. Morrison's have set up a new service that allow vulnerable and elderly residents to phone and order essential food items. The order will take 24 hours to process and will be delivered by Morrison staff. Contactless payments is made on delivery. There is no delivery charge for this service. The customer service phone number is 0345 611 6111. Another really helpful organisation if you have macular degeneration is the Macular Support Group in Coventry, run by volunteers. Judith Misserton kindly invited me to come on their coach outing to the National Memorial Arboretum, where I talked to Mary Buckley, who has some nice words to say about the resource centre and also Rosie. Also, volunteers that help at the resource centre and the macular support group. Here she is, here's Mary. So you like the resource centre, helpful?
Oh yes, very much. It changed my life, and of course I think it's wonderful that the name in the resource centre after Rosie Brady, a lovely lady, a heart and soul, was in the resource centre. So I've met good friends, I've learnt my devices, my iPhone, and wonderful volunteers, and I always enjoy the community broadcast, especially listening to Dave here. He does a wonderful job. Takes me places I've never been to. Anyway, it's wonderful talking to him.
Thank you, Mary. It was lovely talking to you, and I hope to take you to some other places you haven't been via Outlook, no doubt with the help of Graham, our youngest son. Graham Whale goes places on the bus and talks about the pre-9:30 a.m. fare, which often catches me out and I find myself struggling to find change or even stepping off the bus. Here's Graham.
First of all, I'd like to apologise to Mohammed. I think I called him that twice, actually. Nobody picked up on it. But I'm sorry about that. Regarding the bus fare increases, nothing was said about the pre-9:30, 1:50 concession for concession ticket holders, possibly because the press statement came from Transport for West Midlands, whereas the pre-9:30, £1.50 ticket is a concession provided by National Express only. But this was originally apparent when it was first introduced. When it was proposed to put the fares up last July, last year, they put the £1 ticket up to £1.50. And when it was decided to continue the government money to support the £2 fare, the £1.50 concession for concession holders, ticket holders, remained at £1.50 and it's not been mentioned at all on this occasion, as I said before, possibly because the press statement came from Transport Westminster rather than National Express. It would be easy to find out if I wanted to queue up at a call centre. I could find out. Well, it might be easier to ask a driver if I can find one that actually talks.
More from Graham next week, and now another lovely volunteer who was also on the Macular Support Group outing to the National Memorial Arboretum, a member of the team on Outlook, Elaine, who's going to read you a short story about bed in summer.
When I read this poem by Robert Louis Stevenson, I could remember so well feeling exactly the same. That at this time of the year, having been told, come along, it's past your bedtime, being in bed and being able to hear the children in the next door gardens still out playing. Bed in Summer by Robert Louis Stevenson. In winter, I get up at night and dress by yellow candlelight. In summer, quite the other way. I have to go to bed by day. I have to go to bed by day and see the birds still hopping on the tree, or hear the grown-up people's feet still going past me in the street. And does it not seem hard to you when all the sky is clear and blue, and I should like so much to play, to have to go to bed by day?
Thank you very much, Elaine. That was lovely, and thank you for thinking of Postbag. And thank you for all your lovely and helpful messages in Postbag. It really was a great Postbag. Please, let's hear from you next time. Keep it up, please. You can ring up and record a message on 024-76-717-522 and press 5 for Coventry Talking Newspaper. You can ring me up if you want on 024-76-598484. You can send a letter, either written by you or someone on your behalf. Send me an email if you want, davidmonks@hotmail.com, or the official Postbag email address, or any way you feel happiest. But please, let's hear from you. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
Many thanks, Dave, for bringing us Postbag. And now another in our series about villages of Warwickshire, Binley Woods, and it's read by Elaine.
The village, unlike most, cannot lay claim to antiquity, for until 1961 the village of Binley Woods did not exist. However, the area has many historical associations, dating back to the Norman Conquest, when the woods were half a mile long and a furlough broad. The Cistercian monks of Coombe Abbey held here a court leet with gallows and an assize of bread and ale. Situated on the south-east boundary of Coventry and the outskirts of the borough of Rugby, the community that was to become Binley Woods began its modern development in the 1920s, following the sale of the Coombe Abbey estates by the Earl of Craven. During the 1920s and 1930s, people settled in the area, bought land and built homes. In the 1940s, they were joined by homeless people from bombed Coventry, who fled to the comparative safety of Binley and lived in shacks, caravans and anything that could be called home. Some of the original pioneering families still live in the area, and it is that they who can recall the days before Tarmac Adam, when visitors were advised to bring their wellies when they came to call. One elderly resident can remember the days when, if she wanted to go to town, she wore her wellies to the bus stop, left them behind a convenient hedge and donned her shoes. On her return, the wellies were always waiting for her. Eventually, the mud receded and the roads emerged, and the wellies could be consigned to the gardens. Gradually over the years, residents came to enjoy the luxuries of mains drainage, piped water, and when the old gas lights were considered to be too expensive, at £1.12 and 6 pence per quarter, they were replaced by electricity. By the late 1950s, the residents were anxious that the area should establish a village of its own, and no longer be confused with the neighbouring suburb of Coventry, known as Bindley. Villagers were asked to vote, and the name of Bindley Woods was adopted. Since then, the local people have worked hard to create a sense of community. In 1987, Bindley Woods made history when, through a local ecumenical project, the first in Warwickshire, the church in Bindley Woods was inaugurated in the form of the village hall. It is a long time since the woods were half a mile long and a furlong broad, but at least the woods are still there. Safe from development through the efforts of a local group, the Friends of Brandon Wood, the village can now boast one of the first community woods in Europe, jointly managed by the Forestry Commission and the Friends.
Interesting to trace how Bindley Woods became a community and how recently it was officially acknowledged as a village. Now we have Keith bringing us the concluding part of the piece about Liesel Herbst, Austrian tennis player, as researched by her granddaughter Felice.
But it was several years after she first discovered the letters and cuttings when Felice's own daughter said she would like to know about her Jewish heritage, that Felice decided to take a deep plunge into her family history. The more she unearthed, the more incredible and heartbreaking the story became. It was sport that originally drawn Liesel and David together after a chance meeting in Paris before the war. Liesel had been studying at the Sorbonne while David was there celebrating with his football team, representing a sporting organisation called Hakoa, set up for Jewish players barred from other clubs. Hakoa's football team of amateurs had just been in England, where they had beaten West Ham in a famous victory. The pair soon married and Liesel moved with David to Vienna. It was through Hakoa that she started playing tennis seriously. She didn't have amazing technique, but according to my mother, who played at Wimbledon a further 6 times, Liesel had the most amazing stamina and could outrun anyone, says Felice, and that's how she was beating people half her age. Liesel became the top-seeded Austrian woman in 1930, when she was 27, and already a mother to Dawley. In some ways, life seemed perfect for this energetic woman, who was also one of the first female car drivers in Vienna. But by then, there were storm clouds gathering over Austria, as the Nazis, with their particularly virulent strain of anti-Semitism, were gaining momentum in neighbouring Germany. By 1938, when Germany annexed Austria, tennis clubs were once again shutting their doors to Jews like Liesel, whatever their playing skills. It was just a hint of the evils to come. David was forward-thinking and persuaded his wife, who was to remain a proud Austrian for the rest of her life, that they needed to leave. She escaped Austria on the pretext of travelling for tennis. Her bags containing her rackets, while her fur coat was lined with her jewels, and Dawley was smuggled out with a non-Jewish nanny. David joined them in Prague, along with her mother Felice and sisters Irma and Trudy, and Trudy's husband Rudolf and daughter Anna. While Liesel and Dawley then managed to get visas to fly to London, David had to go on a grueling journey throughout occupied Europe, with Nazis constantly on his tail, for his dramatic flight into Croydon. The rest of Liesl's family remained stranded in Eastern Europe. In 1942, Felice and Irma, still in Prague, were rounded up and sent to Theresienstadt, a former holiday resort for Czech nobility, transformed into a ghetto and holding stop for thousands of Jews. Within 17 days, Felice was dead, and Irma lasted just 5 more weeks. Things proved just as difficult for Trude, Rudolf and Anna, who fled to Slovakia, which was being run by the pro-Nazi Roman Catholic priest, Joseph Tiso. In 1942, they too were caught and taken to Novaki, a slave labour camp. In 1944, the camp was liberated during a Slovak uprising against Tiso, and like many families, they fled into the woods, but were caught by Nazis. Along with 700 Jews, they were shot and buried in a huge mass grave. In some ways, it is astonishing to think that while her family was being hunted by Nazis, Liesl was playing tennis. But that was her new life in Britain. When she first started playing tennis again at the Queen's Club in West London, the person she was playing against told her, "You've got to stop being so angry," Felice explains. I think she did take her anger, her frustration, her upset out in her tennis, and of course she was a changed person. When I look back at the photos of her from when she was younger, she was always smiling, but I never really saw her smile properly. I can only think that she had had that survivor's guilt because she had lost her mother and her sisters, but it was something she never talked about. It has taken Felice 5 years of research to put together her compelling book about her grandmother and the rest of the family. Along the way, she has delved deep into archives, met members of her family she had never heard of, found people all over Europe willing to help with her research, and discovered the silence of her family is a common reaction to trauma of the Holocaust. There was this silence, but I so regret that I didn't get to talk to them about what happened, says Felice. I would tell everyone who is young that it is never too late to ask their grandparents about their lives. Everyone has a story which is special. And I would tell older people to make sure they tell their children and grandchildren everything, because otherwise that history could well be lost. The Tennis Champion Who Escaped the Nazis by Felice Hardy, from Adlin Publishers, £9.99, is out now. Visit expressbookshop.com or call Express Bookshop on 020-3176-3832.
What a shockingly sad story, and how important that it should be told and not forgotten. Nigel has been looking into a publishing triumph, the world of audio books, so listen up.
Long before there were books, there were stories. For thousands of years, human beings have been sharing folk tales and fables around campfires and dinner tables. And now that oral tradition is enjoying a digitally enhanced revival, thanks to the growing popularity of audiobooks. Over the past decade, audiobooks have risen to become the biggest growth area in publishing. Last year, UK sales leapt by 17%, and revenue has more than doubled since 2019. In total, UK consumers downloaded 59 million titles between 2022 and 2023. And that's before Spotify made a potentially game-changing market intervention by making more than 150,000 titles available free to UK premium subscribers last year. Big hitters helping to drive up those numbers include Richard Osmond, whose 4 Thursday Murder Club novels were among the most downloaded titles on Amazon-owned Audible, and J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter books all made the list. In non-fiction, Stephen Bartlett's The Diary of a CEO and Rory Stewart's Politics on the Edge have both done big business over the last year. According to research by Spotify, the ability to multitask is the most popular reason, in fact 43%, of people choosing audiobooks, followed by relaxation, with 38% listening at bedtime. And as the holiday season gets underway, many will be looking forward to plugging in their earphones on the beach this summer. Hannah Schowler, an illustrator and teaching assistant from Dover in Kent, says audiobooks suit her lifestyle. Life is busy and it can sometimes be hard to find the time to read, so audiobooks are the perfect way to fit books into my busy days. Whether walking, driving, or just getting jobs done at home, I can be transported away to another world. They're also a great way of sharing stories together as a family. My son and I have been really enjoying listening to Lucy Strange's Our Castle by the Sea on our journeys to and from school. It really makes the characters come alive. Audiobook memoirs are particularly popular, with listeners relishing the chance to hear people telling their own life stories. The best-selling audiobook in the world last year was Prince Harry's Spare, while The Woman in Me by Britney Spears was another huge hit. Michelle and Barack Obama's Becoming and A Promised Land are among Audible's all-time bestsellers, while Billy Connolly's Windswept and Interesting and Bob Matthews' And Away both shifted a high percentage of copies on audio, thanks in no small part to the appeal of the author's warm, familiar voices. I find it the essential medium for modern autobiographies, says Miles Hamer, a letting agent and audiobook fan from Barnstaple in Devon. Intent and nuance are easier to pick up from the author, whereas sarcasm on the page doesn't always travel well. It's also the perfect format for comedy, says Miles. So much of the humour of someone like Alan Partridge is in the delivery, and Steve Coogan's performance, his inflections, voiceful tics and irritability, not just sells but amplifies the comedy. As the market grows, audiobooks are getting increasingly ambitious. For their recent memoir, Beastie Boys' Adam Horovitz and Michael Diamond drafted in an all-star cast including Snoop Dogg, Bette Midler, Chloe Sevigny and Ben Stiller. Audible, meanwhile, has expanded into full-cast audio dramas with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, Andrew Scott and Tom Hardy starring in their recent adaptation of George Orwell's 1984. The history of spoken word recordings can be traced back to the late 1800s when the American inventor Thomas Edison envisioned phonographic books that could speak to blind people, and early audiobooks were indeed aimed at blind and visually impaired listeners. In Britain, the Royal National Institute for the Blind, the RNIB, launched its talking book gramophone records on the 7th of November 1935 with Agatha Christie's The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, believed to be the first available title. In the decades since, the charity has adapted to every advance in technology, issuing its books on tape, then CD, then MP3, and now via smart speakers. It is this digital technology that's also driven the wider boom in audiobook usage. Early RNIB talking books took up an average of 10 record discs, but today you can carry around the complete works of Shakespeare, performed by some of the world's greatest actors, on your phone. And yet, for all their qualities, is there still perhaps a slight stigma attached to the medium, as if it's somehow cheating to listen to a book rather than to read it? I have to disagree, says Hannah. Research by the National Literary Trust found that listening to an audiobook requires the same cognitive skills as reading in print, and that listening to a human voice can elicit a stronger emotional response than reading a written narrative. I see myself as an auditory learner, and I enjoy being read to as a child. So listening to a story brings me a sense of comfort and nostalgia, and it reconnects me to those happy childhood memories.
How heartening to know that reading and listening are still so popular in an ever-changing world. Got Sue now with a piece about stories needing to be told, Africa's secret history.
Can you name the richest man who ever lived? Elon Musk? Jeff Bezos? Paul Getty? It was probably Mansa Musa, the 14th century king of the Mali Empire, with wealth equivalent to £320 billion in today's money. This merely hints at how little we know about Africa and its history, says Zinab Badawi, who is on a mission to put the continent's little appreciated history and culture on the map. The BBC broadcaster hopes her new book, An African History of Africa, will highlight just how much of the continent's culture we never hear about. There is more to it than Tutankhamun and the Benin bronzes. Badawi details the incredible stories of the Kush Empire in Sudan, her homeland. The Kush civilization saved ancient Egypt from invasion and even gave it some of its pharaohs. And she looks at the African culture, art and architecture that has been banned from school books as recently as apartheid-era South Africa and white-ruled Rhodesia. A greater appreciation of the culture and history of Africa will serve the continent very, very well. We need to learn about this. So too do many Africans, she says. Books and films about Africa have usually viewed the continent from Western perspectives. Does Badawi think that, instead of black actors being handed scraps with historically suspect parts in insipid Jane Austen imitations, they could be playing the incredible personalities and enacting stories from Africa that broadcasters and Western-centric history courses never tell us about? She nods enthusiastically and points to the incredible lives of Queen Njinga or Changamire Dombo, both the bane of Africa's Portuguese colonisers in the 17th century, or warrior Queen Kahina in North Africa. They're huge personalities, she says, and that's what I try to do in my book, to tell the history through personalities, because I think history is best understood if it is seared into the imagination. Changamire Dombo, she says, is one of the key figures missing from our understanding of Africa. He was a herdsman who rose to establish the Rozwi Empire across much of the modern-day Zimbabwe, northeastern South Africa, and parts of Botswana and Mozambique. His strategic cunning allowed him to frequently best the heavily armed Portuguese. Badawi notes that Jada Pinkett Smith did produce a docuseries, African Queen, about warrior Queen Njinga for Netflix, although this majored on entertainment rather than the historical facts. The available evidence suggests Njinga was clever, ruthless, very handy with a fighting axe, and sexually voracious. Badawi informs us that the warrior queen enjoyed the trappings of male power and indulged in the services of male concubines whom she required to dress in female clothing and address her as king. From early in her reign, which began in 1624, Njinga, like Dombo, also defied Portuguese invaders, who had already abducted thousands for the slave trade, and successfully waged diplomatic and military campaigns against them. With a wry smile, Badawi notes, however, she was no angel. She did provide enslaved people to the Portuguese in large numbers, and that's glossed over. It's likely, too, that she murdered her nephew to gain power and attacked rival Africans. She eventually asked the Pope to be accepted as a Christian monarch. but Ari's dive into African history and culture is all the better for not being a hagiography of the continent and its people. The book looks, for instance, at the involvement of Arabs and black Africans in the slave trade. It also examines this epochal scar in human history from neglected angles, from family tragedies to economies denuded of the young workforces they needed to grow and develop. The thorny issue of reparations is not one that the book tries to resolve, but it does lay out some convincing arguments over why it needs to be discussed. But more than anything, it's an illuminating look at how the continent's art and culture has been buried, discarded, or denied. The remains of the great Zimbabwe kingdom of the 12th century, 240 kilometres east of Bulawayo, have been plundered and left to rot, and worse, disappeared. The white colonisers of southern Africa insisted that the structures were too sophisticated to have been built by black Africans. In 1871, the German geologist Karl Gottlieb Mauch said this elaborate 11th to 12th century culture had to have been the work of Phoenician or Israelite settlers, possibly under the instruction of the Queen of Sheba. By the start of the 20th century, respected archaeologists were sure the civilization was native African. But thanks to Rhodesia's Prime Minister, Ian Smith, all books on the subject were censored until 1980. His government ruled that no publication could state the Great Zimbabwe was an African creation. Badawi also cites the golden rhinoceros from the 13th century kingdom of Mapungubwe. This object was kept hidden by the apartheid regime in South Africa because it was an inconvenient truth to their myth that it was an empty land devoid of civilization. I think Africans themselves are bereft of knowledge about their own continent, and people outside Africa, plus Africans in the diaspora. This is what I discovered, Badawi says. I would interview people for the book, and they would stay to listen to this or that academic, then tell me they never knew their own country had so much history.
A long overdue African history of Africa, bringing to light personalities, art and culture ignored and suppressed in the colonial past. The summer is upon us, although you'd never know it at present, so here's Elaine listing a few events taking place in July.
What's on at the start of July? Tuesday, July the 2nd to Saturday, July the 6th at the Belgrade Theatre, Frankie Goes to Bollywood, a musical inspired by real stories of British women who have been caught in the spotlight of the biggest film industry in the world. Friday, July the 5th at the Albany Theatre, What's Wrong with Benny Hill? Mark Carey's musical comedy explores the life and legacy of a very peculiar and brilliant comedian. July the 6th, Saturday, the Albany Theatre, Rhythm of the Dance, where music and dance combine in a choreographed journey through Ireland's history. On Friday, July the 5th and Saturday, July the 6th, as part of the Cadira Festival, which is being held in the War Memorial Park, Autumn Dance present The Giant Wheel. Although another event said it could well be called Out of the Deep Blue, as Autumn Dance are giving a moving performance inspired by the beauty, power and impact of people coming together from different walks of life. There'll be lots more going on at the Godiva Festival. Saturday, July the 6th is a very busy weekend. A Summer Cayley, 3 hours of live music and dancing in the Cathedral Ruins. And on Monday, July the 8th, an event worth hearing about is the Torch Relay. 62 Coventry schools are currently participating in a torch relay in honour of the Paris Olympic and Paralympic Games. The torch relay will come to an end on Monday, July the 8th, with the Flame of Friendship finale. The University of Warwick will see over 1,000 pupils and teachers join the procession as an Olympic-style torch passes by, making its way to the Arts Centre. What's on from mid-July? From Wednesday, July the 17th until Saturday the 27th, the Belgrade is hosting a programme of new plays, workshops and conversations between artists and audiences. See It First is an event for the curious, for artists in search of inspiration and audiences in search of a new programme. Thursday, July the 18th to Sunday the 21st, Albany Theatre is hosting the National Drama Festival, which celebrates the cream of amateur theatre across the British Isles in a long weekend of award-winning productions. The weekend of July the 20th and 21st sees the Caribbean Reggae Fever will be in the War Memorial Park from 11 o'clock each day. From Friday, July the 19th, right through to September, the Herbert Art Gallery and Museum's Summer Exhibition comes complete with giant sunflowers, bursts of rainbow colours and sounds and smells that awaken inner tranquility. Entitled Joy, Inspired by Nature, it is an eye-popping wonderland that playfully connects us to nature. An event with a difference is at Fargo Village on July the 27th, when all aspects of facial hair will be celebrated at the Beard Festival. Thursday, July the 25th until Sunday the 28th is Warwick Folk Festival. Now in its 45th year, the festival boasts the very best in contemporary and traditional folk arts from the UK and beyond. As well as an extensive lineup of performers, the four-day event features workshops, dance performances, children's entertainments and a festival village. And from Thursday the 25th of July until Saturday the 27th at the Belgrade is My Mother's Funeral, The Show, a new play by Kelly Jones which tackles the inequalities around death and the cost of turning your loved one into art.
Elaine there with news of what's on in the local area. And lastly, we join Dave and Graham on part two of their trip to Bath and Bristol. They attend a tribute band concert, the Bootleg Beatles, and talk to someone with a personal Beatles story from the 1960s.
Okay, we're off to see the Bootleg Beatles. Sitting next to Sandra Woodruff, waiting for the Bootleg Beatles to come on. So you remember the Beatles, don't you?
I do, very well. From 1963, they were playing in the Odeon down at Weston-super-Mare. Jerry and the Pacemakers were a supporting act there. My friend and I went down to Weston in the morning, and we went onto the pier at Weston and asked two chaps who were running the ghost train if they knew where the Beatles were staying, and they said, if you go and buy us 10 packs, we'll tell you. So we had to get them 10 Woodbine each, and then they said, right, they're in the Royal Pier Hotel, so along by the old pier.
Yeah.
So we went along and we stayed outside all day, watching them coming and going. They had their own vehicles. George in his dark green Jag. John was driving a white transit van. And then we noticed Jerry's brother, Fred Marsden, who was the drummer in the Pacemakers. For whatever reason, I don't know why, but he suddenly told us one of the Beatles' room numbers was 49. So we noticed that the Beatles had all gone out of the hotel, and the doorman wasn't in the front. So me and a couple of other people ran into the hotel, found room number 49, wasn't locked, the door, just opened the door, went in, and looked around for something we could pinch that they wouldn't be cross about. And in the wardrobe, there was a whole pile of new Woolsey cotton ribex briefs, all white pants, because you didn't have coloured ones in those days, like July 1963. And so in between every now and again was a card saying Woolsey cotton ribex briefs and all this blurb about it, how to measure yourself to see what size you needed. So I pinched a card. My friend pinched a record sleeve from a 45 that had George Harrison's name on it. So we assumed, the Bible was open on the bed, so that was interesting. We assumed that it was John and George's room, that they were sharing that room. So I pinched this card, and then the manager came and said, I'll get the police, and we raced out. 2 days later, went down to Weston again with a different friend and took the card with me, and I'd also took my camera and took lots of photos and got them to sign the card out of the wardrobe. And Paul McCartney said, now we know who was in our bedroom. But there was no animosity, it was just... So I've lived on that story, as you can imagine, for many, many years. Well, since then, since 1963, when I was 16 then.
Did you scream at the Beatles?
Yes, I did, and lots of other girls did. And I know it seems silly, and how could we hear them? But we could hear them. We could hear them, but we just have to scream. I don't know why. I don't think they do it these days, but we just did. You just couldn't help but scream at them. They must have been exasperated sometimes with what the girls got up to, really. But there we are. It was a fantastic era.
You enjoying the bootleg Beatles, Graham?
They've been very good, yeah.
Been excellent. I've been up dancing with Sandra here. It's the morning after the night before. Didn't we have a fantastic night with the bootleg Beatles?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was up there on the dance floor, rocking and rolling, set all night. Fantastic. They were really great. Here we are, we've arrived in Bristol, Graham. So we've got some interesting things on the wall of the train station.
Yeah, it says about the train station in Bristol. This is designed by Edinburgh Kingdom Brunel. He also designed the Clifton Suspension Bridge, a lot of the railways.
Ships as well.
Ships, yes, that's Great Britain, yeah.
That's moored here. Yeah. Now, one famous thing about Bristol is on the hills, what can we see?
Yeah, coloured houses, different coloured houses, yeah.
There's a whole line of different coloured houses on the top of the hill. And a big hello to listener Richard Bignall, who was born near Bristol. Right, now, there's a cafe here, but alongside where the picnic tables are.
The old train lines, yeah.
Fantastic. And there's what represents level crossing as well, across the train lines. Where have we arrived now, Graham?
We're in the Temple Gardens, and there's a bombed out church, yeah.
Wow. It's very impressive, isn't it?
that the tower is remaining, but it seems to be leaning a little bit.
Yeah, leaning a little bit, yeah.
Yes. So that was probably caused by the bombing. We've come into a chocolate shop now, and there's a record player. There's a vinyl record on it, and lots of vinyl records, which we used to call records, didn't we? Are you allowed to play the record player? There's a record on the Boys Are Back in Town, which applies to us. So, can you stick it on, please? Yeah, great. And I'm looking forward to drinking your hot chocolate.
Oh, good.
Great. Okay, so what's the hot chocolate like, Graham?
Very good, yeah.
Very good. Okay, so what's the chocolate making shop called? I can't read it. It's backwards in the window.
Ruby Hugh.
Ruby Hugh?
Yeah.
Oh, great name. Thank you very much indeed. Nice hot chocolate, lovely. And the marshmallow on top. You make the marshmallow yourself, don't you?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you. So who was the Boys Are Back in Town recorded by?
Finlayson.
I'm speaking to a young gentleman. Now, you're involved in cycle tracks, right?
Yeah, I work for a charity. I'm a fundraiser for a charity.
Yes.
And we're called Sustrans, which stands for Sustainable Transport. Yeah, born in Bristol, this charity, but it's UK-wide. We've created the Bath to Bristol path, and we've got the chocolate path around here, and the Festival Way, things like that.
Excellent.
And up in Wales as well, in Scotland, everywhere. Every county, I think.
And so you're trying to encourage more people to cycle.
Yeah. We are trying to encourage more people to get on their bikes, and also walkers as well, and joggers, and joggers to use the paths that we create. Yeah, we're trying to create infrastructure for people, essentially.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you very much. What's your name?
Simon.
We're about to go to the train station.
We're in Castle Gardens at the moment, yeah.
Okay.
It's down by the river in Bristol.
Yeah. And we're going to the train station, are we?
Yeah, back home, yeah.
Yeah, have you had a nice time?
It's been great, yeah.
I've had a fantastic time. Thank you very much, Graham, again. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.
Yes, I was around when the Beatles set out, but I never could understand the screaming which put an end to their live concerts. That's all from this week's programme, so it's goodbye from me, Stella Roberts, and all the Outlook team. Outlook will be back next week.